In 1981, Klein read a small newspaper article about a Vietnam veteran named Gary Cooper, who went berserk and died in a shootout with the police. The story attributed his behavior to his depression over losing his job and his depression over witnessing the parades and ceremonies that the released Iranian hostages were welcomed home with. Cooper had returned home from Vietnam with a serious leg wound, but never received a hero's welcome. After Klein wrote a magazine article about Cooper, he decided to locate and speak with some of the other surviving veterans of Cooper's unit, men who were exposed to strains similar to those which broke Cooper, but who managed to build a more balanced adult life. His portraits of Cooper and his four fellow Marines are the focus of Klein's new book, Payback, Five Marines After Vietnam. Payback follows the story of these men on the battlefield, where their only wish was to stay alive, and the decisions they made in the years after the war, when they had to build adult lives as if nothing had happened. Payback is published by Knopf. Joe Klein is a contributing editor of New York Magazine. Joe, did the article that you read not attribute that to the things that I mentioned?
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, I just had this feeling that having not read the newspaper article that you read, that perhaps
it was you who had attributed that, not the article.
Okay.
It was a little item in the back pages of one of the New York tabloids, either the Post or the Daily News, Viet Vet goes berserk over hostage return. And I was intrigued by the fact that the guy not only was angry about the hostages, the reception that the hostages had received as opposed to what he'd received, which was nothing, but also the fact was that he was unemployed, an unemployed steelworker. He'd been trying desperately to find work. His family was one of those families that came up from the south to the northern industrial belt. When the steel industry and the auto industry began to boom in the 40s and 50s, and now the migration was shifting back to the Sun Belt. The guy's name was Gary Cooper. It was kind of mythological, and it combined a whole bunch of American themes and myths, and so I decided to do a story about it.
What did you then want to track the other men from his unit and see what happened to them?
Well, I went and I talked to Gary's widow, Barbara Cooper, in Hammond, Indiana, and she brought out a scrapbook. And Gary was a month older than I am. I'm 38 now. And these were people my age. And they were kids. And kids dressed up as soldiers, carrying guns, trying to seem macho. And it was an experience so totally different from mine. I mean, I didn't know anybody who was a Vietnam veteran. And I was curious about what had happened to them. I mean, if 2 million Americans served in Vietnam, where were they? They didn't hang out where I did.
So you wanted to find them, not only for the story, but to see your counterparts in a way.
That's right. To find the other half of my generation.
Was it hard to physically find them once you knew who the names were? Did you have trouble being a detective and tracking them
down? Well, I kind of enjoyed doing that, but as a matter of fact, I had to do that when I wrote Woody Guthrie to find Woody's third wife. But in this case, the Marines would only give me the hometowns of the guys. And so I would, like with William V. Taylor Jr. In Chicago, all I knew was that he was from Chicago. And I had to go pouring through phone books and calling Bill Taylor's. Actually, I found him in the suburbs of Chicago. But eventually I found 20 of the guys from Cooper's platoon and went traveling around the country speaking with them. And I chose four others in addition to Gary to write about, and I chose a range of responses. I didn't want to choose the five worst cases. This is not a book about the plight of Vietnam veterans. This is a book about the experience of Vietnam veterans and, in a way, the experience of the rest of us over the last 15 years.
Did they want to talk to you about this? Because, really, I mean, a lot of veterans have not been anxious to talk about the war, maybe until recently. But you were calling up as a stranger, asking them to talk about perhaps the most profound thing and life-threatening thing that had ever happened to them.
They did want to talk about it. They even wanted to talk about it to someone who had been on the other side in the 60s, as I was. I was an anti-war, person. I marched. But no one had ever asked before, and I was asking specific questions, and I knew about other people from their unit, and they were curious about other people from their unit. There was only one guy who was really reluctant to talk to me. He had never talked about it at all. He had blocked it for 15 years, and as a result of my call, I went and visited him, and he began to talk. He couldn't stop talking for 24 hours, and then he decided to go to a vet center and started going to this vet center weekly, and now he's the Vietnam veterans representative at the factory he works at in Indianapolis.
Were you surprised that they hadn't kept up with each other?
No, absolutely not. We're getting to one of the major differences between Vietnam and every other war that's been fought. In World War II, let's take Leon Uris's unit, the unit that Battle Cry, the novel, was written about. They trained together in California. They spent 3 years together in the South Pacific, hopping from island to island, you know, liberating islands. During the 3 years, they spent maybe 30 days in actual combat. And they all came home together on the same boat. With Vietnam, each guy rotated individually. Each guy spent, in the Army, 12 months, in the Marines, since they always have to be tougher than everybody else, it was 13 months. And they each left individually. And one thing I realized when I got these guys together for a reunion was that all I had was a snapshot of one day of the platoon, one day in Vietnam, Operation Cochise, August 16th, 1967, which is the beginning of my book, the last day that they spent together in the war. And so when you go individually and when you leave individually, there often isn't the time to take everybody's addresses. And so there have been very few Vietnam reunions, and that also explains the real emotional importance of the government vet centers that have opened, because it's the first time in 15 years that the guys can get together and talk about what they experienced there.
Operation Cochise, which you just mentioned, was the last battle that they shared together and their last shared memory. Can you describe a little bit what that battle was like for the men who fought in it?
Well, it was a horrible day, but the remarkable thing about it was that it was like almost any other day. Almost all the battles in Vietnam were the same. Inevitably, the Americans would be assaulting a paddy or walking through a village, and they would be ambushed. And then they would call in fixed-wing jets and napalm the Vietnamese or, pound them with artillery. In this case, the ambush was a very professional one sprung by North Vietnamese regulars, and the American squad was trapped within 60 feet of the tree line, and they were used there, they were pinned down there and used as bait for the rest of the day in order to lure other Americans down to try and save them. Several of the guys who I write about were trapped, and every time they tried to move, they would be fired at, but they were purposely not killed in order to hold them in place. And there were some remarkable stories of courage, involving these guys and involving their getting out of that paddy that day.
Did you find that their personalities on the battlefield offered any clues to what they were like years after the war?
Yeah, I think it does, and it does and it doesn't. I mean, there are two schools of thought about how battle affects people. One is the school of thought that it represents a real major break from the rest of your experience, and it causes tremendous trauma afterwards, the post-traumatic stress disorder. There are others who believe that you take into battle and you react to battle the way you react to other things in your life, and that it's kind of a magnifying glass of your personality. And I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, but I think that in the case of the guys I wrote about, at least in a couple of cases, it was a magnifying glass of their personality. One guy, Dale Zeminski, specialized in great escapes and creative truancy when he was in high school, and he pulled the greatest escape of his life that day at Operation Cochise, crawling on his back for 2 hours through withering fire to get to safety. Various people told me afterwards that it was the single most courageous act that they had ever seen, most willful and courageous act they'd ever seen. What happened to Dale Zeminski when he came home? He's been trying to replicate the high of that moment ever since. He's been trying to escape wives, responsibility, automobile wrecks. He destroyed a Corvette every 6 or 8 months for about the first 3 or 4 years after he came home from Vietnam. And he's been searching for that high, searching for, the great escape ever since.
Gary Cooper, who's the first vet that you followed, the one who had died in a shootout with the police, was wounded in Operation Cochise, and he was, like, helicoptered out with the wound. And you described him as saying after he got shot, I'm out of here, because he knew that the wound was serious enough.
But he was wrong. He was wrong. I mean, you had to have a pretty serious wound to get out of there. There's one scene in the book. One of the guys, it's really interesting thing about Vietnam and how it's different than other wars, was John Steiner, who is now an environmentalist with the Fish and Wildlife Service in San Francisco, spent two tours over there. And during that time, he fired hundreds of thousands of rounds out of his rifle, and at only two times did he point it at a living target. The first time, the second time actually, was when he killed two pigs we thought were food for the North Vietnamese, but the other time was when he shot his friend in the leg in order to get him out of there. And they consulted with a medic, and the medic said, you can't just do a foot anymore because we can heal him quick enough so that he'll be back. You have to do something fairly serious. So he shot him in a shin bone. Gary Cooper's wound was a flesh wound, and that was just about nothing.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Joe Klein, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Payback, Five Marines After Vietnam. Two of the problems that I think everybody who you talked to shared was the difficulty of figuring out what kind of job they wanted and finding a marriage that was really going to work, finding a mate, or being able to keep a relationship going. Do you think that that's kind of like typical, not only of them, but of, you know, people?
Well,
maybe just typical of our generation in general or life in general.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the reasons why I found doing this so compelling, such a draining emotional experience, because I think in a way these guys walk point for the rest of us. I think that their experience of the last 15 years is a kind of intensification of ours, of the rest of ours. And I'll tell you why. I started by telling you a story. John Steiner comes home, lands at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. Waiting for his flight back to San Francisco. There's a TV in the waiting room, a bunch of grunts, maybe 100 soldiers sitting there watching this teenage talk show. Perfectly formed, beautiful host interviewing a perfectly formed, beautiful young girl in a bikini. He says to her, what do you think of Vietnam? She says, Vietnam, I think it's a downer. A ripple goes through the room of grunts. What, downer? What does that mean? That's a word that didn't exist before. Well, they kind of figured it's not something good. Then she says, I think the real heroes are the guys who went to Canada. The guys who went to Vietnam are just a bunch of baby killers and murderers. Now, after World War II, she would have been the young woman who was in Times Square throwing her arms around every sailor and soldier in sight. I mean, the difference in those two things is remarkable. But what John Steiner found when he came back, and what these other guys found when they came back, was that America had changed. It wasn't so much, I mean, Vietnam veterans' experience is different from World War II veterans in that the wars were different, but the big difference is that America changed. The America that the World War II veteran, that the Korean War veteran came back to, was essentially the same country they left, same values. But the country that Vietnam veterans came home to was completely different. All the ground rules had changed, from what a girl would do on the first date to the attitude you were supposed to have toward your boss, toward your family, toward religion, toward the government. All the institutions had been shattered, and we experienced the same thing, but we experienced it in a continuous fashion. I mean, the changes were much more gradual for us. There wasn't the great break that there was for Vietnam veterans. They were like Martians coming back and to a completely different country. And what they had to do was, first of all, celebrate their return. If no one else was going to congratulate them, they had to congratulate themselves, and they did an awful lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll during those first 3 or 4 years, by and large. But eventually they had to settle down, and they had to figure out, well, if all these institutions are shattered, what are we going to take for ourselves, and what are we going to leave? We all had a chance to invent our own lives over the last 15 years, and these guys were starting from a point, a much more basic point than the rest of us. And the one thing that I find that's most touching about their lives is the struggle to create families. I think that their feeling, you know, the respect for government never came back. These guys have no respect for politicians any more than most of us do. Respect for the boss never really came back, although fear of the boss has come back in the last 4 or 5 years with the bad economy. Religion, some cases, yes, some cases, no. But the one institution that we kind of questioned and shattered in the 60s and 70s that they really have fought very hard to deal with is and to establish for themselves is the family. To me, the five wives are almost more interesting than the husbands because they're more diverse and they put up with an awful lot. I mean, the struggle of John Steiner, basically a very decent guy, to try and communicate his feelings to his wife Eve is very poignant. The struggle of Bill Taylor to be a father to his kids. It's a really striking thing how strong the bonds between parents and children, fathers and children, are among Vietnam veterans. It's a very important thing to them.
Are there any areas that the vets who you spoke to didn't want to discuss?
Well, no one particular area. Some were more sensitive about some things than others. Eventually, almost all of it came out. I mean, you know, sex is always tough. But eventually most of them talked about that too. It's interesting. Most of them had problems with impotence at about the same point in their relationships.
Really? Which point was that?
2 months in. During the course of this, I mean, there were a lot of hairy moments when we were, you know, guys were dealing with very sensitive things, and I'm not a trained psychiatrist, and so I had some psychiatric backup. I had several people who were helping me, and one of them, John Talbot, who's now the president of the American Psychiatric Association, when I told him this about the impotence, he said, "Well, of course." He said, 2 months is when you begin to think when the novelty wears off and you realize that you're in for the duration and you're making a commitment.
So it was, you think, fear of commitment?
Yeah,
that was responsible for the impotence.
I think that they experienced. I think all of us kind of feel that, but I think that they experienced it a lot more intensely than the rest of us. Again. You know, there are a whole bunch of things that they experience a lot more intensely than the rest of us. I think we've all been kind of poisoned by chemicals, poisoned by dioxin, but they experience that more intensely than the rest of us with Agent Orange. I mean, there's no smoking pistol there. There's no proof that Agent Orange created a whole raft of problems that Vietnam veterans claim it caused. But once again, they experienced a problem of modern-day American life more intensely than the rest of us.
Well, you know, I think a counterpart, I don't know if this would hold up or not, but a counterpart experience to the experience of before being in the war and after being in the war was for a lot of people of that same generation who didn't go to war going to college, because so many people, like, changed in the 60s when they were in college. You know, they changed their hair, they changed their clothes, they changed their values, they changed their idea of what family meant to them. Some of them changed their sexual preference, you know, and then mm-hmm. there was this kind of like before and after split in their lives.
But there was a continuity to it.
The change happened gradually, they desired it.
And nobody was ever shooting at them. I mean, these guys experienced those same things, only they were just tossed into it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember what it was like being in college. I remember from my sophomore to my junior year, everything changed. That was the summer of love. That was the summer of Operation Cochise, as a matter of fact. And I know that my hair was appreciably longer after that summer than it was before it, but the hair grew gradually. You know, these guys came back and they knew that the war was a phony, and they wanted to join the rest of us, but it took a long time for their hair to grow out.
Well, did you find, though, that they were at odds with their pre-war personality? That the person who they were before the war was someone who they didn't much know anymore and didn't understand any longer?
In superficial ways, yeah. But I think in the most basic ways, just as with the rest of us, I think in the most basic ways, there's a continuity there.
My guest, we're talking about Payback, Five Marines After Vietnam, and my guest is Joe Klein, the author of the book, who's also the author of the acclaimed biography of Woody Guthrie that was published just a few years ago. And, you know, one of the people who you spoke to wanted to drop out toward the end.
John Wakefield.
Yeah. I mean, it had just, I guess, become too emotionally intense for him. Can you describe what that was like when he said, you know, that's it, I don't think I want to be in the book?
Well, John's an interesting guy. I talked about him a little while ago without mentioning his name, but for him, he had blocked the war for 15 years, and he had committed atrocities over there before he joined the Grunts. He was a member of Force Recon, which was the Marine elite, and they would go up to North Vietnam in four-man teams and do assassinations and torture people. And he had blocked an awful lot of that. And after I came on the scene, kind of blithely calling him, "Hi, I'm Joe Klein. I know some of your old friends." He began this process of going to the vet center. And he did an interesting thing there. He's a very smart guy. And he would seem very sympathetic. He would allow himself to admit a few things here and there, but he would never really open himself up. And the other guys in his group at the vet center were beginning to get hip to him. And finally, they closed in on him, and they made him talk. And all along he had said to me, "I'm not going to tell you everything. I couldn't possibly." And maybe somewhat to his frustration, I said, "Okay, you know, fine." And finally, when he did talk, a couple of things happened. One was that he found that he didn't feel any guilt about the things that he had done, and that troubled him. But I think what was more troubling him was that these secrets had separated him from the others at the vet center, and indeed from, you know, the others in Indianapolis. It made him a special, unique, important person in his own mind, that he had been a member of the elite in the Marines, and he had done something so important that it had to be secret. And now he no longer had that. Now he was just another guy in the quality control department at Detroit Diesel Allison. And that disoriented him for a while. And that was the time when, it was during that time he said that he wanted to drop out of the book. And, you know, that upset me, and I never quite came to a conclusion about what I was going to do about it. I was going to let it sit for a while. I wasn't going to say, "You can't do that," you know. What can I say? I mean, I so disrupted the guy's life to begin with. It was, you know, only took a couple of days before he changed his mind again. He wanted to be part of it. I might add that that all five of the people, Barbara Cooper and the four guys, have read it and accept it, and got together last weekend in New York to celebrate the publication.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, actually, didn't you attend a reunion that they had?
Well, I mean, after I started getting in touch with them, they began expressing interest in each other and what happened, and we organized a reunion in Chicago, the coldest weekend of the century. And seven of the 20 whom I interviewed were able to make it. More were going to come, but because of the weather, they didn't. It's really amazing how compelling it is when Vietnam veterans get together. I don't know whether you've ever experienced this, but it's always amazing to me because they've been so isolated for so long. They went through such incredible things, and there was no one they could talk to. I remember one night in Indianapolis, I was with John Wakefield at a vet center, and sitting in on a group just to get the experience. And one guy says, "I was a minesweeper in Vietnam, and one day I was supposed to be sweeping a road, and I missed a mine, and a truck full of soldiers came along and blew up, and the soldiers died, and it was my fault. John Wayne wouldn't have missed that mine." And there was a big fat guy there eating a hero sandwich. I guess you call it a hoagie here in Philadelphia. And he said with his mouth full, "Screw John Wayne." And the whole circle of people just exploded into laughter. It was as if 15 years of pent-up, you know, frustration over the fact that none of them could be John Wayne just exploded at that moment. And it never fails. These guys, even this last weekend in New York, it was the second time they got together, things start coming up again. Things start coming out. And they start asking each other questions and remembering things and admitting things.
What were the things that they most wanted to talk about at the reunion? Because they hadn't seen each other for over 10 years, right?
They wanted to admit that they weren't John Wayne.
At the reunion, too?
Yeah. I think that, you know, the dirty secrets finally could come out. John Steiner could finally admit that he shot this other guy in the leg to send him home. At the time in Vietnam, it was an accidental discharge. He said, you know, they called the medic, accidental discharge. But everybody knew that he'd actually shot the guy to send him home. They could admit that they fell asleep on watch. It was interesting, though. It took Barbara Cooper to admit the dirtiest secret of, well, the next dirtiest secret of all.
Which was?
Which was that they were scared. She said, you know, the toughest thing for these guys was that they were scared over there. And then they had to come back here, and there was this image of how men act in America and how you're supposed to be strong and never be frightened. And they couldn't. And when people asked him what was it like over there, they couldn't say I was scared to death.
You describe the wives talking at this reunion, and the men thinking, "Oh no, the wives are ganging up on us."
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of anger among the wives. They were angry at me the first year. I mean, I spent 3 years. Doing the research. This isn't the kind of book where you could go and interview someone for a week and it's over. I mean, the wives were really angry at me at first because they'd say, why does he talk to you and not to me? And eventually they started to talk to me too, and they started to talk to each other. And at the reunion, John Wakefield's wife went up to Barbara Cooper and she said, you know, we have something in common. And Barbara Cooper said, what? And Elizabeth Wakefield said, we both married one of them. And Barbara Cooper said, yeah, never again.
One of the people who you interviewed ended up getting hypnotized and relived one of the battles. What was the reasons for that, and how do you think the results changed him?
Well, it's hard, you know, it's hard to say that anything changes anyone. I can't. I just describe what happens. I don't analyze, you know, or at least overtly analyze. I can't say that it did. I know it changed me, but it was John Steiner. He's the environmentalist, and he did it. He kept on insisting, "I want to be hypnotized to remember Operation Cochise to help you, Joe." And I said, "No, you don't have to do it. I don't. You know, don't do it for me." And I think what he really wanted to do was to go back there himself. He's an environmentalist, and he said to me, how could I have burned villages, and he did 17 years ago, and be so upset about saving the salt marshes now? How can I be the same person? So we went to a hypnotherapist, a very distinguished guy in his field in Berkeley, and we tried to relive Operation Cochise, and John would not go down into the valley where the battle was fought. He couldn't get himself to go down. And so Jesse Miller, the hypnotist, started from the end of the battle. He said, what'd you do when it was over? John said, we walked through the tree line the next day. How did you feel? I felt angry, and I felt sad. And when he said the word sad, he just exploded in tears. It was a remarkable moment. I was terrified. I thought he kept on trying to pull himself back together, and it kept on exploding out again. And I was crying. It was really upsetting. I thought that, you know, that he might not be able to put himself back together again. But he did. And he lives a very wonderful, peaceful, helpful life in San Francisco.
Let's talk a little bit about the effects of all these stories on you. You've described yourself as more or less the counterpart of these men who didn't go to the war. You're the same age. Did you feel, let me put it this way. I'm sure you read like the Chris Buckley column in, I think it was Esquire, mm-hmm. over a year ago.
How about the cover of Esquire this month, Why Men Love War?
Oh, really?
By Bill Broyles. He reviewed my book in Esquire last
month
and apparently
right.
got carried away. As a matter of fact, I think he's in Vietnam right now. You know,
but there's been this whole thing. Like, I'm sorry
right.
I didn't go. It would have really changed
well,
me.
Well, that's baloney.
They went through. They became more adult, more
people,
men.
People ask me if I feel guilty. People actually ask me if I feel guilty for not going, and I say no, I don't feel guilty. The war was wrong. Each one of these five guys would agree with me now that the war was wrong. As a matter of fact, one of the things they have in common is that when they came back, they started reading about it. And then they got really angry because they didn't know about the French involvement. They didn't know how futile, how stupid it was. But on the other hand, there were two things that make me angry. Number one, that it was they who fought it, the working class and the poor, and none of my friends, all the people I knew were able to get out of it. And I think this may be controversial, but I think that we have to have a military draft so that everybody serves in wars, because it becomes a little bit too convenient, a little bit too easy to send the poor off to Grenada or El Salvador or Nicaragua. If there are college kids involved, if there are people who are reading and thinking and the children of the powerful involved, we might be a little bit less likely to have wars. Another thing that leads us to have wars, and I think it's the dirtiest secret of Vietnam, is this business about the Chris Buckley business. I'll tell you, I felt curious. I wondered how I'd hold up under battle. If John Steiner, the most gentle person I know, could make it through Operation Cochise, could I have made it through? I think that there's something, it's the biological interrogatory. I think that there's something primordial in men that causes them to see something challenging and romantic about battle, and I think we have to guard against that.
Well, one of the ways that's always gotten expressed is through war literature. Yeah, and one of the things that I think writers who have experienced war have taken back from it is like great material for a novel. that's something you, of course, never had the opportunity to do. I mean, you couldn't write a great war novel having never fought in a war, but you've just written like a war book in which you have, I think, incredibly well-written scenes of war, and you've pieced these scenes together from talking to all these people. You didn't experience it yourself, but it's like really great war writing. did you ever like want to write a war book, or I mean, did this give you an opportunity to write action scenes or anything like that you would have really wanted to do? I'm not saying that you wanted to go to war to do it.
I'm going to admit to an aspiration. My goal is to write nonfiction versions of great American novels. I'm going to spend the rest of my life. This was The Naked and the Dead. I want the next one to be Peyton Place. No, I mean, in this form, you can write things that you can't get away with in a novel. When a guy yells, "Help, I'm bleeding to death," in the middle of a battle, you couldn't get away with that in a novel anymore. But when Dale Zemensky actually yelled it, you can write it. The battle was one of the hardest things to write. And, I kind of chuckle at these oral histories of wars. Studs Terkel, in his one about World War II, stays away from war stories. But one of the things I find is that battle is one of the most personal acts. It's like going to the bathroom. People are very embarrassed about describing it. When someone starts talking to you about a war and about what they experienced right off the bat, you can toss away 90% of it. It is a very personal thing. You're seeing people at their rock bottom selves. And it took me 6, 7, 8 times. It took an awful lot of trust with each of these guys. It took them talking to each other with me there for me to get the degree of verisimilitude that I got. If indeed, I don't know if that's the way battle is. People seem to be saying that in the reviews of the book and seem to be remarking on it. But, it wasn't an easy thing to get.
If your aspiration is to write the nonfiction versions of great American novels, what was your Woody Guthrie biography?
Well, that was before that.
Okay.
Well, actually, Woody Guthrie might have been Huckleberry Finn.
Uh-huh. Do you think that the Vietnam War is always going to be like one of the defining moments of our generation?
I think it's going to be a turning point in the history of the country. I think C. Van Woodward wrote about the difference between the North and the South. He said the difference in the South was not slavery, it wasn't the relative degree of economic sophistication, it was the sense of loss. And that the thing that defined America up until 1970 was that we had never lost a war. And I think that the preponderance of nostalgia, the yearning for the past, the whole Ronald Reagan, phenomenon of wanting to turn back to not America in the 30s, but the MGM vision of America in the 30s is a consequence of Vietnam. I think that if it teaches us that things are complex, then it'll be a lesson that was well taken. But I think that if it makes us yearn for a place that never was, the America before then we'll have to relearn it until we get it right.
Well, we're out of time, I regret to say. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been interesting. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And I've been speaking with Joe Klein, and his new book is titled Payback, Five Marines After Vietnam. That's Payback, Five Marines After Vietnam. It's published by Knopf. He's a contributing editor to New York Magazine. He's written for Rolling Stone Magazine and is also the author of the acclaimed book Woody Guthrie, A Life. The new book, again, is titled Payback. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening Monday on Fresh Air, but first let's check in with shadow traffic.
Motorists heading for the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge this afternoon, be advised they're having an opening right now, so steer clear of that. Northbound 95, still slow 1 mile approaching Ray Street through Aramingo, where the two left lanes are now open and the two right lanes are blocked, still a 15-20 minute delay. And traffic on the westbound Schuylkill Expressway, a 6 minute delay through the University Avenue detour. You'll also find it slow approaching Strawberry through the crossover to the Roosevelt Extension. That's shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Chris Knight.
That shadow traffic report was funded by White Glove Cellular Phones. This Sunday at noon on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with Max Weinberg, who's the drummer for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll hear a National Press Club broadcast with Charles Manatt, who's the chair of the Democratic National Committee. Last